John Waterman, author and explorer, congratulations on your new book, Atlas of the National Parks.
Well, thank you. It's been a wild ride.
Talk about that wild ride.
Well, I had a year and a half to do the research and writing for this, but unfortunately I had 43 years of going to national parks, even working at national parks, volunteering at national parks. So I had to sort of compress all that knowledge along with a lot of scientific research into a year and a half. But fortunately, I work with a great team at the Geographic.
Mm-hmm. It's a National Geographic book. What's it like working for Nat Geo?
I love working for Natty Geo, as they call it.
Natty Geo.
Because in most instances, they have funded my travel. So I have made a habit in this lifetime of going on long journeys to learn mm-hmm. and develop a sense of place. And fortunately, a lot of those journeys over the last few decades involved travel in national parks. And not ordinary travel. I mean, I kind of bloodied my knees a little bit and really got to know the wild places within.
Especially up north, Denali, Alaska.
Yeah, certainly. You know, in Alaska, there's 20,000 square miles of national parks. That's the size of the country of Iceland. I'm just saying parks, not refuges and monuments.
National parks, you're saying.
That's correct. And, you know, throughout there, you know, there's enormous glaciers and, you know, wildlife galloping hither and yon. It's the wildest country imaginable. It's the frontier. But we still have that in the lower 48. You know, despite what we might hear through the media about the crowds of Yellowstone, let's face it, most of those millions of people every year aren't getting into the backcountry. Mm-hmm. And the habitat there is so extended. It stretches down south all the way to the southern borders of Grand Teton National mm-hmm. Park. So these places are national treasures.
If we could just step back and go into a little bit of the history. I love history. And I think the history of the national parks is fascinating. Which is the first national park, Yosemite or Yellowstone?
Yosemite was actually deeded from the feds to the state of California. And Abe Lincoln asked them, the state of California, to look after it. And then eventually the feds took it back in the way that they do. So technically, Yellowstone was the first national park, although there was an earlier national park 40 years before Yellowstone set aside for the public, but it didn't have that national park title. And that was one of the smallest national parks of them all, the Hot Springs in the state of Arkansas, Hot Springs National Park, mm-hmm. which didn't become an official national park 2 years later, but it preceded the creation of Yellowstone.
What determines how an area gets designated as a national park?
Well, there are lots of ways that can happen. I've mentioned the National Geographic's role in it, and it mm-hmm. usually takes a tremendous amount of congressional lobbying for a park to be created. And then if Congress is so moved, they vote on it, and the vote succeeds by a majority. They write an act, and then the president has to sign the act. And there are other instances in which the president can act by executive order and create a monument or a national park. But to answer your question more specifically, there are a set of criteria that the Park Service uses, that Congress looks for, that lobbyists will badger Congress with. And that contains lands of superb architecture and beautiful natural scenery. But there are many other criteria as well, and that could include, you know, cultural or anthropological treasures such mm-hmm. as Mesa Verde mm-hmm. National Park. Denali wasn't actually created in Alaska for its highest mountain. It was created really for its wildlife. They thought of it as a game reserve. So, you know, wildlife populations figure strongly into this.
Now that's Mount McKinley, right?
Originally named Mount McKinley in Obama changed it in 2015 to Denali National Park, mm-hmm. even though the state of Alaska has long officially called it Denali National Park. It took until 2015 to change the name. It was always called Denali by the natives of Alaska.
What does Denali mean?
It means the high one.
Like Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. That's your favorite park, correct?
Yes, it is. Arguably, I've spent more time there than the other parks, but not only became obsessed with the mountain itself, but I started doing trips where I finished climbing the mountain and ski off the mountain and then walk out and sometimes have boats dropped off for me and then boat back out to civilization. And I really developed a sense for the greater rugged wilderness surrounding the nation's tallest mountain.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a place that is essentially primeval and completely undeveloped, and the wildlife is royalty there. You don't mess with the bears of Denali National Park. They're not happy bears like down south. They don't have a lot of salmon to eat. Mm-hmm. It's the landscape is as it's always been there. There's no, with the exception of an 80-mile dirt road leading to some gold mines in Wonder Lake, there's no development in that park whatsoever, and it's the size of the state of Massachusetts. It's an enormous landscape, and it has, like many other parks, it has tremendous biodiversity from migrating birds in the summer that migrate as far as 10,000 miles a year to the herds of caribou, wolverines, and you can routinely encounter this wildlife if you're on a trip through the backcountry or simply riding the shuttle bus. The animals, wildlife that otherwise wouldn't see, is completely habituated to these public shuttle buses. Mm-hmm. So they see these huge yellow buses come down the road with lots of tubes sticking out the windows as clicking goes on.
Talk about the evolution of the National Park Service. I mean, the evolution of the legislation that has influenced this national parks movement.
Well, it was a noble ideal and still is, even though it's been mishandled by our present administration. And there was nothing like it in the world at the time, and there still isn't. It explains why we have so many foreign tourists that come to our national parks.
America's best idea.
Yeah, as that came directly from the novelist Wallace Stegner, who appreciated wild country and conservation of these places. But to answer your question in a long-winded way, working with the National Geographic has been a dream come true, particularly on this project, because the National Geographic was instrumental in the creation of the National Park Service.
Really?
And lobbied Congress extensively and even funded the institution when they were talking about it in 1914, 15, and then in 1916 when the National Park Service was created. And they continued to lobby Congress extensively. They create special issues of the magazine about potential new parklands and hand them out to every member of Congress. But that's just a little bit of the backdrop of this particular book. More importantly, this was an ideal because it was obvious to the powers that be in D.C. that we had so many wildlands and so many incredible natural resources in need of protection. And if the right people got together, and I'll let the book show people the actual details, but the right people got together and, you know, essentially created a mandate that would preserve these places for perpetuity, open to all. And there were a lot of things that came along with it in this mandate for the national parks and what was known as the Organic Act.
The Organic Act, 1914.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It set it up, set
right.
up the service.
And the parks were also set aside for science. And that's why I can so handily discuss climate change in this book, is because the parks have been recording meteorological data now for more than a century in many instances. So we're able to examine not just the weather, but the trends, which allow us to come to conclusion about changes. within these very fragile places.
Talk about that and the impacts on our parks, from the Everglades to Denali.
Well, the Everglades is the most endangered national park, a place that I've been to repeatedly. I'm going to return to it later this winter. And that's because of largely as a subset of climate change and water. Lack of freshwater recharge from the north, water's being diverted to the huge 6 million plus population of southern Florida, and sea level rise. Even storm surges are beginning to encroach upon the Everglades. And by 2100, even with a moderate 2.5-foot sea level rise, we're going to lose half of the Everglades.
Because the glades are freshwater.
The glades were created, incredible biodiverse marshlands filled with wildlife and extraordinary plants and animals. And there's a sort of a very calibrated mix of freshwater with salt water, brackish water, where mangroves thrive. And if that balance is upset by sea level rise or hurricane storm surges, the mangroves are killed and the mangroves migrate further north. So increasingly, if you talk to locals in the Everglades who've been there all their life, they've seen devastating damages. But climate change, it's important to address this because a recent study of the national parks and of the surrounding country from coast to coast by UC California at Berkeley has shown that our national parks are much more susceptible than the average land throughout the rest of the country.
Really?
Because,
why?
Face it, national parks are created in places that are at high altitude or very arid places. Mm-hmm. And so more than generally, these parks are much more affected by changing trends and temperature. So all the more reason to protect them, just simply because they're more fragile.
John Waterman, author, photographer, explorer. Congratulations again on your new book, Atlas of the National Parks, and thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.